better living through chemistry. Hit it, Tommy.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Oh, the classic Tom Lehrer, sounding like he could go on forever, but in this song, he actually can't. The periodic table of elements he's singing there contains 92 substances, no more, no less. Discovered in 1869 by Dmitri Mendeleev, who, while tinkering with the weights and atomic numbers of the substances in the universe that could not be broken down, the so-called elements, stumbled on the periodic table. And it seemed like a message from God, or the cosmos, really. It was as much a riddle as a list. Hugh Alderson Williams joins us. He's the author of the new book, Periodic Tales, A Cultural History of the Elements from Arsenic to Zinc. He joins us from our partner, the BBC, in Norfolk, England. Hugh, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
First of all, the periodic table is a very special kind of riddle that was presented to the scientific world in 1869 that sort of indicated that you have to fill in the blanks, and the blanks were clear. It's just that finding the elements was not so clear.
Yes, well, Mendeleev had the genius to leave blanks. That was his real breakthrough in making the periodic table. And then he had the great pleasure over the next 30 years of his career and retirement of watching people gradually, one by one, fill in some of these blanks.
And, of course, you were born too late to really be able to fill in any of the blanks. But
they're still doing it.
Well, but you decided that rather than do what Marie Curie did and discover radium, you would discover, for instance, how you could be a source of, say, phosphorus.
Yes, I'm much more interested now in the way the elements are in our culture. It's something we've tended to forget. Chemists keep them sort of locked behind laboratory doors, and in fact, the elements belong to all of us.
By culture, you would say urine?
In art and literature, and I lighten the book by doing some simple experiments where I think I can have a reasonable chance of making the element myself. Phosphorus is actually pretty hard, but I made iodine from seaweed, for example.
But you did look in your own waste products for a source for phosphorus.
I'm afraid I did, yes.
Unsuccessfully. And you tell the story in the book, Periodic Tales, A Cultural History of the Elements from Arsenic to Zinc. You know, the other thing that's interesting is you really... you know, have this very simple sort of, I wonder where I could get some, say, plutonium. How did you actually try to get yourself an element called plutonium?
Well, I mean, the idea of the book is to build my own periodic table. So, you know, if the elements belong to all of us, I ought to be able to get a little bit of some from somewhere. And plutonium is obviously going to be difficult. I did once work with plutonium in a laboratory, so I sort of had a fond memory of it. A brief, you know, interlude of proper chemistry for me. And so I went shopping for some, and obviously was met with slammed doors. But then I found a homeopathic remedy shop that had homeopathic plutonium. And this was very interesting to me because it shows how the idea of plutonium, if not the actual substance, has entered our culture. And plutonium, we tend to think, is this sort of embodiment of evil these days. Plutonium perhaps takes the place that the element sulfur took in biblical times.
Why is there this universality to the periodic table in the sense that within it, it says there can be this many elements, there can be no more. Atoms can be configured in these various ways and no other ways. It's produced in you a kind of populist notion that the elements belong to all of us.
Well, it's not quite as fixed as that. I mean, they are still discovering elements. They decided on the name of 118, I think, Copernicium, as I was writing the book, and it's still open-ended. And in principle, the periodic table needn't always have the shape it has. The shape it has that was laid down by Mendeleev works pretty well, but if someone came out with a better one, the shape would change. So it's just an imaginary system for organizing these fundamental aspects of the universe, the elements.
We're speaking with Hugh Aldersey Williams, author of the new book, Periodic Tales, A Cultural History of the Elements from Arsenic to Zinc. And Hugh, while your book it's been described often as this love story to the periodic table, this has also been kind of a sticking point for chemists that the periodic table very literally sort of limits their field of study. And in your book, you list the famous tale that involved physicist Robert Oppenheimer, who told his colleague he was no longer a first-rate chemist but a second-rate physicist, and that was a promotion.
Well, there's always been this rather snippy little hierarchy in science that physics thinks itself above chemistry, and they both think of themselves above biology, and really where the excitement is these days gives the lie to that, because there's much more excitement in biology, I think. Chemistry as a discipline and as a brand, in a way, finds itself squeezed, I think, in a funny sense. And although the elements are all around us, chemistry has become perceived as difficult and slightly unfashionable, certainly compared to either physics or biology.
Explore for us the love that architect Daniel Libeskind expressed for the substance zinc, and why perhaps there isn't that same kind of love for, you know, barium or zirconium or even something like erbium.
Well, barium would be a very poor building material because it's far too reactive, so you're not going to ever see a lot of it around in an obvious way, but we do see it in fireworks. Zinc has a very fine tradition as a building material, although it was a relatively recently discovered element in sort of late medieval times and only kind of began to be applied in the 17th, 18th centuries. He was working in Berlin on the Jewish Museum there, and there are two sort of reasons for this. The obvious one is that many buildings in Berlin use zinc cladding to, you know, as weatherproofing, and so he wanted to, you know, make it fit in the context. But there is also a sort of Jewish element a Jewish aspect of the story about zinc symbolizing sort of wandering and loss, and obviously the Jewish Museum in Berlin in particular has a lot of that symbolism associated with it, and so this helps to reinforce that.
Did you yearn for the same kinds of stories and symbolism in all of the elements as you wrote this book?
It would have been a very, very long book if I'd found them in all the elements. I mean, I enjoyed finding them in some peculiar elements, like vanadium, for example, which concentrates in sea sponges. And the American Army once wanted to see if it could use sea sponges to extract the vanadium to make stronger steel.
Sea sponges. Well, we were talking about arming the rebels in Libya. Actually, the Pentagon wanted to turn sea sponges into a strategic asset.
Well, that might be, if they're off the coast there, they might look at that again.
Yeah, Gaddafi needs to be afraid of the sponges. Hugh Alderson-Williams, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Hugh Alderson-Williams is the author of Periodic Tales, A Cultural History of the Elements, From Arsenic to Zinc.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.